I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. We'll end today's show by talking about a film that recently premiered at the Telluride Film Festival.
Salinger was a national story, a shooting star.
At the height of that success, he disappears. He became the Howard Hughes of his day.
Mr. What you're hearing is the trailer for Salinger, the new documentary about the famously enigmatic novelist J.D. Salinger. The film looks at how Salinger's writing, most famously his novel The Catcher in the Rye, has affected people across the globe. One of the people who spent a lot of time studying that writing is Dr. John Wenke, a professor of English at Salisbury University. Dr. Wenke was interviewed for the documentary Salinger, and we caught up with him earlier this week to talk about one of our nation's most notoriously reclusive writers.
Well, Salinger connects directly to people. Now, he does that through the voices of his characters. One of the things that any reader of The Catcher in the Rye suddenly feels is that they are on the other end of this conversation. In fact, the book is really cast as a conversation. Holden is talking directly to somebody in some kind of hospital or rehab place or whatever it might be, but he is having a conversation. And part of the magic of the beginning of The Catcher in the Rye is that we immediately feel that we as readers are there. Mm-hmm. And it's the quality of voice that makes Holden not simply a literary figure, but he becomes a kind of personal presence in the lives of people in ways that I really haven't seen for any other writer.
And, you know, every author is trying to make a connection with their reader base. Do you think that's why Salinger and even the character of Holden Caulfield is so beloved, you know, this many years after it went to stands?
I think that is why Holden is beloved, but he's also despised by certain people because he's a boundary breaker. Mm-hmm. But part of it is that he experiences what I think is universally true for most people, that we have a sense of angst about being alive, certainly about being teenagers, about growing up, about, you know, forms of authority that may be oppressive, about trying to find meaning and value in a world that appears to be very, very corrupt. One of the things I think is really strong and important, and it becomes ultimately ironic, is that the morality, if you want to call it that, in The Catcher in the Rye is pretty conservative. Mm-hmm. Holden does his best to get rid of expletives as they are being scratched in the world. He's very worried about children being corrupted. What could be a more powerfully moral, in the best sense of the word, than that?
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your involvement in this documentary. There's a lot of buzz nationally about this film. Tell me how you got involved in it and that first call from the director. Tell me how that went.
I wrote a book about Salinger's publishing life from the perspective of his evolution as a short story writer. I basically looked at the stories of the 40s as being foundational, all of which are not reprinted. You have to go archivally and dig in and find things that are very, very hard to find. And I basically tried to get a developmental approach to what he did in order to turn himself into the writer of Holden Caulfield and the Glass Stories. The book has been, I think, well received, and Shane Salerno read the book. Somebody from his office called me when he was beginning work or into work on the documentary, and they basically wanted to interview me on camera, which they did, and I basically talked about what I know about Salinger, which is the evolution of him as an artist, as a literary artist.
Yeah. What's the most fascinating thing for you, and when people see this film and this documentary and they start learning about, you know, kind of the things behind the curtain that Salinger worked so hard to keep from the general public, what do you think people are going to be the most surprised by?
Well, I think, I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm in it somewhere. I don't know how much or how little. But I do know that what Shane Salerno wanted to do was to create a kind of multi-layered approach where the life and the work and the iconic presence, both as celebrity but also absence, works together to create a very, very complex portrait of an important artist in the 20th century. Everything about Salinger prior to The Catcher in the Rye was designed to make himself into a public presence. Everything that is about Salinger in the aftermath of his great success has him moving away from that kind of celebrity, the sort of celebrity that most writers would give their left or right arm, whichever arm they don't use to write with, they would give their arm for that kind of success. So it's really a human story, but it's also a story about how our culture responds to somebody who is basically not only playing hard to get, but being successfully living in avoidance of the public and the literary and the cultural marketplace.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting point, because what most people know about Salinger is the reclusiveness of the author post his success, as you mentioned. Tell me a little bit about J.D. Salinger before he became famous and before he wrote Catcher in the Rye, how he was promoting himself, how he was marketing himself as an author.
He wrote a number of short stories that were specifically designed for particular magazines. He had the Saturday Evening Post story. He had the story that would maybe be in what we might consider a cosmopolitan story. He was a very, very careful student of the marketplace. He also cracked the New Yorker fairly early. His story, Slight Rebellion Off Madison, an early Holden Caulfield story, was, I think, accepted for publication in either 1940 or 1942, but it was held until after the Second World War ended for publication. So he, from a very early time in his career, was highly successful in being able to place his material in the right kind of venue. And again, that tells me that he was a very, very careful marketer of himself. He was not the artist hiding in the woods, talking the Jesus prayer as Franny does in the Glass stories. He was somebody building the career, not quite Norman Mailer-esque, but he was a very careful self-marketer.
It's interesting to me because Salinger was an author that didn't publish anything post-1965 to his death in 2010. One of the biggest revelations that come out during this documentary is that there are going to be five new Salinger books that are slated to be published between 2015 and 2020. What was your reaction when you heard that there were new Salinger works that were in that, you know, are coming up?
Originally, there are two ways of looking at it. Either Salinger is writing or Salinger is not. I always had the feeling, like a lot of other people, that a writer doesn't simply give up being a writer. I thought that Salinger viewed himself through the identity of being a writer. And that doesn't mean that he's going to publish. So I always thought he was writing. Now, the big question is whether what he's writing is more open to mass market enjoyment than the last thing that he published. The last piece that he published, I think, is as unreadable as any piece can possibly be. It's sort of ironic and probably comic that the New Yorker was pretty much cleared of everything other than advertising and Hapworth 16, 1924. And when you get into it, it's a 30,000-word letter by a 7-year-old mystic. It's basically a reading list, like a bibliography. It's unreadable. There's nothing in it that constitutes what I would think of as fiction. But what this new revelation tells us is that there is another Salinger world. What apparently is true, he wrote more material about Holden Caulfield to supplement and extend The Catcher in the Rye and the earlier stories, and he wrote more Glass stories. So what that tells me is that he was a serious artist who wanted to basically put on record these two families, these families that he created in a kind of Faulknerian world. And when you're dealing with a serial narrative like the Glass stories, you have everything that's on the page, but then you have this imagination of all the things that are not on the page. And in between one book and the other, you have a sense that the life is being lived in a kind of real way. So I think that's really what Salinger was going for. He subverted, or he hid himself, kept himself out of the picture so that his creation could go forward without him. And I am absolutely convinced that he organized and is meticulously controlling the revelation of this other authorial self from beyond the grave.
The documentary suggests, or at least some of the press surrounding the documentary, you know, before its release, seems to suggest that Salinger's experiences in World War II essentially defined his life. It's implicated, or it's alluded to, that Catcher in the Rye can be read as a war novel. Do you think that that's a true theory?
I wouldn't say it's a theory. I would say that it's a valid fact that one could take that approach. But I think one would be more capable of taking that approach by reading the 5 or 6 or 7 stories that Salinger wrote during and after World War II that had Holden Caulfield in them. In one of the stories, Holden Caulfield is missing in action and presumed dead as a casualty of the war. After the war, Salinger brought him back to life and finished however many drafts he had written of The Catcher in the Rye. But I think the war defined Salinger very, very profoundly. Seymour Glass was a casualty of the war. He would have what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder. The first story in the Glass family saga, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, ends with the suicide of Seymour Glass, which ironically is the beginning of this sort of Faulkner-like expansive family narrative. So there's no doubt that Salinger was traumatized by the war. One of the things that Salerno did was to, he hired an investigator for a number of years, went through Europe and found all kinds of powerful material about Salinger in the war, his relationship to liberating a Nazi death camp and so on. So these kinds of events are, I think, not only embedded within the fiction of that time, but couldn't help but to have transformed him. There's one point in The Catcher in the Rye where Holden imagines riding an atom bomb. He wants to sit on it. And I've always thought that in some way it either accidentally or actually predicts what happens at the end of Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. I probably shouldn't say this because I was thinking at one point of maybe continuing to write about it, but what the heck. I think it's either accidental or somebody read the Catcher in the Rye and Holden is riding this bomb down. And there's a real anti-war sense within The Catcher in the Rye, anti-violence, anti-war, anti-corruption of innocence. So I think that Salinger took from the war a sense of war's horror. Mm-hmm. And from that point of view, he's an awful lot like Kurt Vonnegut, who survived the firebombing of Dresden and is clearly a World War II author. So Salinger and Vonnegut and other writers like Norman Mailer took from their experiences of the Second World War a sense of war's horror, and they projected that into their narratives.
Yeah. I'm going to stay on that topic of violence for a moment. Another of the issues that the film raises, that several killers, including Mark David Chapman, who murdered John Lennon, of course, said they were influenced by Catcher in the Rye. Do you think that there's any tie between Salinger's reclusiveness and perhaps that being a reason that he was impacted by that and why he kind of, escaped from the public eye, that he was disturbed that his work had influenced people to violence?
I think Salinger probably felt no responsibility. I don't think any artist would. I think he was probably horrified. I think that he probably felt that The Catcher in the Rye, because it was powerful, could do powerful good things, but within a distorted imagination, powerful works can also be warped and wrapped up in somebody's horror, whatever you want to call it, either craziness or evil. I don't have a working understanding of who Salinger was. I'm sure I will after I see the movie, a better sense. But I think he would have had to have been absolutely appalled. But I also think that somebody like Mark David Chapman would have found another reason to shoot John Lennon. I don't think it's Holden Caulfield telling him. It might have been another book or another voice, but somebody inclined to do that kind of thing is going to do it.
Yeah. You mentioned the word appalled a few seconds ago there. Critics of this film, or even people that are looking at it from a long view, say that the irony, perhaps, is that, Salinger may have hated or at least been reluctant to having his life portrayed the way that it is in this book and in this documentary. Did that give you any sense of pause when you were approached about being involved in this project?
For 25 years, which is a long time, Salinger was a working literary artist who accepted the fact and the reality of being a public figure. And once you've done that, I think you have to take the good and the bad. He could not unmake his own history. I think he responded to it. There are some people out there who think that this was a calculated marketing move. I'm not one of them. I think that in the evolution of his life, he came to reject the very force of public life that he assiduously attempted to create. So I had no problem speaking about what I knew and what I experienced, which was his work. And I think Salerno is totally within his rights to pursue what is a great story. It's a great story at the individual level. It's a great story at the artistic level. And it's a great story at the cultural, iconic, personality, celebrity world. I think that Salerno worked 10 years, put a couple $1 million of his own money, highly dedicated. He is an artist. Mm-hmm. And I think that the product will indicate not only his devotion to his craft, but also his devotion to trying to render the truth of this very important but highly enigmatic person, Salinger.
In this day and age, do you think it's possible for an author, a musician, an artist of any kind, do you think that you could be as perhaps shying away from celebrity and public domain and public life the way Salinger did, and still be successful at the art form?
I think you'd have to look at somebody like J.K. Rowling and imagine a J.K. Rowling who decided to drop out. I don't think she has that particular kind of attribute, but she created, obviously, an unprecedented kind of worldwide renown, and did something I think great, which is to bring people of all ages back to reading. So we could do a thought experiment, and we could imagine that J.K. Rowling might do that. And I think to some extent she tried to do that with The Cuckoo's Calling, which I haven't read. She tried to write without being J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. and she pulled it off until the cat was left out of the proverbial bag. So I think she attempted to project herself as an artist without the baggage of being the world's first billionaire author. So I think it's possible. I think somebody that successful could very easily become repulsed by the demands of being a celebrity, because we're all human beings inside our own skin. It's, I think, very difficult, I would imagine. I'm not one of these successful people, but I think it would be difficult for somebody to simply have themselves perceived as being this commodity, this entity that is somehow not human.
We've been speaking with Dr. John Wenke. He is a professor of English here at Salisbury University. He's also featured in the new documentary called Salinger. To learn more about this documentary or to see a list of the new works that will be published in the next few years by J.D. Salinger, click to our website, wamucoast.org. Dr. Wenke, thank you so much for chatting
with
me.
Thank you. I had a great time, and I look forward to seeing the movie, and I hope everybody out there would like to see it too, and also buy the companion volume.
You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm Brian Rousseau.